From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Steve Earle has a new CD called El Corazon. Earle's career was once described as a high-speed wreck with the carnage strewn down the highway. After hitting the top of the country charts in 1986, Earle's career was derailed by a drug problem. We'll feature a 1996 interview about his current comeback after rehab and a stint in jail. Also today, Dogs in Drag. Photographer and painter William Wegman talks about the dogs he immortalized in his art. Wegman has a new book called Puppies. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the band that made the Bob Dylan record that never was. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Japan says a ban against shipping companies entering U.S. ports is unfair. From Tokyo, Michelle McGee reports.
Japan's transport minister has accused Washington of violating a commercial treaty, barring Japanese ships from entering U.S. ports. But the minister said Tokyo is not considering retaliatory measures at the moment and will wait for the outcome of ongoing negotiations. The U.S. ordered that Japanese cargo ships be banned from entering U.S. ports starting later today after Japanese shipping companies failed to pay an estimated $4 million in fines levied by the U.S. Washington is demanding that Japan reform its port practices, which it says discriminates against foreign companies and drives up costs. If negotiators fail to reach an agreement, the dispute could have an enormous impact on trade between the world's two largest economies. For NPR News, I'm Michelle McGee in Tokyo.
The crew aboard the space station Mir is getting ready for next week's long indoor spacewalk. The crew will try to fix the station's power supply. Early today, the cosmonauts practiced moving through hatchways inside the station, wearing their bulky space suits and practicing delicate maneuvers. Meanwhile, astronaut David Wolf practiced boarding the Mir's escape capsule, where he'll stay while the spacewalk is going on. In August, the Mir crew fixed the station's power supply, damaged during a cargo ship collision last June. But a mechanism that moves the solar panels into the best alignment with the sun is not moving, so the station doesn't get as much power as it really needs. President Clinton today told a group of business leaders in Buenos Aires, Argentina, that they should work to make sure that increased trade leaves no one behind. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton delivered another sales pitch for open trade today, telling a business group in Buenos Aires that Argentina's strong economic growth was laying the groundwork for his plan to create an open market that includes the entire hemisphere. But he said that free trade would only work if the burdens and benefits were shared fairly.
That means deepening democracy and the rule of law, including the free press and the independent judiciary that serve our citizens everywhere.
Freedom of the press is an issue throughout the region, but particularly in Argentina, where journalists have reported hundreds of cases of violence and intimidation. The president heard about those concerns today when he sat down for a roundtable interview with Argentine reporters. Later today, Mr. Clinton travels to San Carlos de Bariloche, a resort town in the Andes Mountains. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Buenos Aires.
About 40 U.S. military engineers are helping set up temporary housing for earthquake victims in central Italy. Two units of the U.S. Air Force 31st Fighter Wing are clearing land to build prefabricated houses. Two strong quakes last month killed 10 Italians and caused widespread damage. There are still severe aftershocks. On Wall Street, the Dow was down more than 50 points at 7,888. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower for a third straight session. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors continue to express concern about corporate earnings. Today, weaker than expected results from Sun Microsystems and Seagate Technology have created a rout in computer-related issues. The market is also being pressured by concern about higher interest rates. That's after this morning's reports on industrial production and housing starts showed unexpected strength. Adding to the negative tone is the decision by the Federal Maritime Commission to ban Japanese cargo ships from U.S. ports. Investors are fearful about an escalation in trade tensions. I'm Doug Krisner.
A published report says IBM is looking for ways to cut costs. The Wall Street Journal reports Big Blue has started to offer a job buyout plan to most of its 241,000 employees around the world. The journal says the cost-cutting move could potentially eliminate thousands of jobs. Coca-Cola has posted a more than 4.5% increase in third-quarter profits, in line with analysts' predictions. Earnings were up about $1 billion, or 41 cents per share. Meanwhile, the company has taken no action over its longtime chairman, Roberto Goizeta. He was recently diagnosed with cancer and has been hospitalized in serious condition with an infection. The board says it's confident that the company's current management team is sufficient for the present. Sears Roebuck & Company says its third-quarter profit climbed 27% from 1 year earlier, but the retailer is warning that poor performance in its credit card business will hurt future earnings. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was down more than 50 points at 78.88. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steve Earle is a singer, songwriter, guitarist who has made a comeback after kicking addictions to heroin and crack and serving several months in jail on possession charges in 1994. He has a new CD called El Corazon. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with him last year. Steve Earle's first album, released in 1986, positioned him within country music's new traditionalism. It went to number one on the country charts and was later described in Newsweek as helping to galvanize Nashville out of its post-Rube and cowboy cheeseball slump. Since beginning his comeback a couple of years ago, he's had three CDs, Train A Coming, I Feel All Right, and his new one. Let's start with a track from that new CD, El Corazon. This is his song, Telephone Road.
My brother Jim and my other brother Jack went off down to Houston and never come back. Mama wasn't gonna let her baby go yet, but there ain't nobody hiring back in Lafayette. Working all week for a Texaco check. Sun beating down on the back of my neck. I try to save my money, but Jimmy says no. Says he got a little honey out on Telephone Road. Come on, come on, come on, let's go. This ain't Louisiana, your mama won't.
Steve Earle from his new CD. When I spoke with him last year, I read a paragraph he wrote in 1995 that he used on a liner note. He wrote, "When I was locked up, I was getting ready to go off on this boy who stole my radio. My partner Paul asked me where I was going. I said, to get my radio and then to go to the hole for a little while. He looked at me like I look at my 13-year-old sometimes and said, no, you ain't. You're going to sit your little white ass down and do your little time, and then you're going to get out of here and make a nice record. So I made two." I asked Steve Earle what that paragraph was about.
Just about exactly what it says.
Who is Paul?
Well, a friend of mine that I knew from the street, and I got into jail, and he was there. And he was... one of a couple of people that I hung out with when I was locked up that I knew. Two of them I knew from the outside. One of them was a guy I met in there. But one of the safest ways to go in an institution is to belong to as small a clique as possible, because they'll put 50 men in one cell. And so when stuff happens, it happens a lot faster than the guards can do anything about it. So it's a really potentially volatile environment. If you belong to a big clique of people, you know, 10 guys, 20 guys, you can't control their actions, and they may do something and because to make somebody else mad, and because and that person that they've irritated may not have access to them, and then may go off on you in the recreation area or in the gym or someplace else where the situation's not so controlled. So I sort of stuck in. We had one little corner of this 50-man cell that we sort of stayed in, and except to go and take showers and stuff. And it was just people that I knew, and they did take care of me because I was very sick when I got to jail. I was withdrawing from methadone and cocaine, and I was extremely ill. And Paul got me. I had an upper bunk, and by the third or fourth day, I couldn't even get in my bunk by myself. And Paul helped me get up there, and he also made sure that I secured a bottom bunk when the upper bunk became totally unworkable. He'd been there for about a year and a half when I got there, and never had been to trial. And he's still there, as far as I know.
How long were you in this prison?
I was in 60 days. I was doing a year. I was doing 11 months and 29 days. After much begging and pleading from my lawyer and 30 days in treatment, they finally decided to probate the rest of my sentence.
Now, you grew up in San Antonio in a pretty middle-class family, right? Your father was an air traffic controller.
Yeah, I was very middle-class. We moved a lot. We were renters, so we lived all over the San Antonio area. I grew up... what I really call home is a town called Schertz that's right outside of San Antonio, and it's sort of been engulfed by San Antonio now, but it was about 30 miles outside the city limits when I was growing up there. Randolph Air Force Base is there. There's about 5 Air Force bases in San Antonio, which are the major industry, no matter what anybody thinks.
You dropped out of high school in 1971, and really wanted to, write songs and perform. You started hanging out with the songwriter Townes Van Zandt. Why him? What excited you about him? Or was he one of the few songwriters that you actually had access to?
Well, he was one of the few there were a lot of songwriters in Texas that I could have access to. Actually, it was a pretty damn good place to be a songwriter when I first started writing. I mean, there was Townes and Jerry Jeff and Steve Fromholz, and who I saw the other night for the first time in years. There was a lot going on in Austin, and of course, naturally, everybody was telling me, "Hey, this is you don't need to go to New York or L.A. or Nashville because we got, the music business is coming to Austin. This is going to be the next music industry center." Even at 19 years old, I knew that wasn't true. The weather's too good, the girls are too pretty, and the dope's too cheap, and you can't get anything done in a place like that. So I came to Nashville.
Well, let's hear a song that you wrote that Travis Tritt recently had a hit of. And you recorded this on your next-to-last album, Steve Earle, Train A-Comin'. This is called Sometimes She Forgets. When did you write this?
Yeah, go ahead. It's an old song. It's an old song. It was written during the period when I was getting up and going to the office and writing songs every day. And I wrote what I thought were a lot of really commercial songs, and they told me that they were too country, so none of them ever got recorded until this one did last year.
Well, I like the song a lot. What do you think of it now?
I'm real proud of it. It's always been one of my favorite songs I've ever written. The songs that survived to make it on to Train A-Comin' were the older songs of mine that I seemed to always dust off when I went out and did a solo acoustic tour. That was the main criteria.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Steve Earle.
If you see her out tonight, and she tells you it's just the lights that bring her here and not her loneliness. That's what she says, but sometimes she won't guess. If she tells you she don't need a man, she's had all the comfort she can stand. You'd best believe every word she says. But don't give up, 'cause sometimes she forgets.
Steve Earle from his previous record called Train A-Comin'. Now, you've said you first did heroin when you were 13. How did you do it? How did you get it?
Well, it's San Antonio, Texas, during the Vietnam War. It was 150 miles from the border, so there's a constant supply of real strong, real cheap brown heroin, and then the Vietnam War going on. So there was lots of dope, and it was very, very cheap. Dope was cheaper than alcohol in the city I grew up in.
Who turned you
much
on?
Much cheaper. It's a lot of people at school, my uncle, and who also gave me my first guitar, so that was sort of a mixed deal. But
did your father know?
My father, I don't think they knew the extent of my drug habit. My music always seemed to intervene enough. Like, I moved to Nashville, and the heroin the heroin up here sucked, so I sort of stopped doing it. And it was until I got to where I could afford it, and started traveling around other cities where there were better drugs. And I slowly drifted back into doing it again. When I stopped doing heroin, I replaced it with other drugs. But it, my parents, they were aware. It became an issue in around the house a few times, but I was pretty good. I was an addict. Addicts are good at getting over. And I managed to convince the psychiatrist I was sent to that I was cured, and he pronounced me cured, and that was the end of it as far as my family was concerned.
Did you keep your habit hidden from people in the record company, or do you think that they knew?
They knew. I was nowhere near as good as hiding it as I should have been, in retrospect. I was sort of, I think I thought I was invisible, and that got worse as my habit became worse. I think as long as I was performing, as I was making shows, which I did till the very, very last, as long as I was making shows and making records, there were people that just sort of turned their back on it. It made them uncomfortable, but they turned their back on it. There were other people that I think actually thought it was kind of cool, as long as it wasn't them. And I probably fed off that to a certain extent. It's just one of those deals. It's not that... It's really your tendency when you're in active addiction is to think that you're special. The way I looking back at it now, I was doing the same thing that all addicts do. It's called permission to use. And I didn't need a reason to take drugs. I was an addict. I could always tell you one if you asked me, but I didn't really need a reason. Just being an addict was reason enough.
At the periods when you were most addicted, were you able to perform? Were you able to write? Was there music in your head? I mean, had music remained a part of your world?
No, it got to the point where it wasn't at all. The last 2 years especially, I didn't... I hung out in South Nashville for a lot of reasons. It's where the drugs were, but I could have beeped people and they'd have bought me drugs. And one time I did it that way. I didn't have to hang out there. One of the reasons I hung out there is black people do not listen to my music, and so I was fairly anonymous there. And people just left me alone as long as I had money to pay for drugs. And it's not... I got to a point that... It was a full-time job just to get up in the morning and get my hands on enough money to support my habit. Whether I had money or not, I still had to go get it, and I used it up at such a furious rate that I was always a little bit ahead of my royalty checks. I didn't have to do some of the things other people have to do, but I would have. There's no doubt in my mind, if the bottom had just fallen out, I couldn't get any more money, I would have been stealing stuff to support my habit. It was just a matter of time.
So the habit just drove music out of your head?
It drove it out of my life. There wasn't any time. I didn't even have a guitar. I'd traded them all for dope in the middle of the night or pawned them. And I lost a lot of nice guitars. But it really was, even if I'd had a guitar, I wouldn't have had time to play it. I woke up in the morning and I was on the trail from the time I woke up until I went to sleep, which was usually 3 or 4 days later.
Did the degradation aspect of it ever get to you, of being so
sure
enslaved
did.
To the habit and having lost something that was so special for you, your music?
Yeah, I mean, it. I know when I started to die, and that was when it got to the point that I couldn't write anymore. And I knew I was dying, but I just didn't think that there was anything that I could do about it.
Now, when you were in prison, you ended up in rehab during the prison stay. So you were addicted when you got into prison. Were you able to kick during that rehab stay?
Well, I went to a hospital. They finally realized that they didn't want to be responsible for me at age. I was 39, and I wasn't in the best physical condition, and my blood pressure got pretty high, which is a withdrawal symptom, and they decided they didn't want to be responsible for me being in the Metro jail anymore. So my lawyer worked it out for me to go into treatment. I was still an inmate, But I went to Lincoln Regional Hospital, which is down in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and I did my medical detox there, and that means that they basically give you medication to control your blood pressure and monitor you. And the food was a lot better there than it was in jail. It was just a matter of once I got there, I don't know what happened, but something, I guess the fog cleared because I actually had been physically restrained from taking drugs for several weeks, and that hadn't happened to me in years. I probably wouldn't have gotten clean if I hadn't gotten locked up. I know I wouldn't have. I would have just died.
My guest is Steve Earle. He has a new CD called El Corazon. We'll hear more of our 1996 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1996 interview with Steve Earle.
When did music start coming back into your head?
As soon as I got to Buffalo Valley and in jail, there
the,
aren't
the
any
treatment
guitars.
Center.
Yeah, there aren't any guitars in jail. That's just in the movies. But in Buffalo Valley, I was allowed to have a guitar an hour a day. And I wrote Goodbye, which is on Train to Come. It was the first thing I'd written in 4 years. And I wrote Hardcore Troubadour, which is actually a melody that I'd started 3 or 4 years before, but I wrote all the lyrics and treatment.
Why don't we hear Hardcore Troubadour? It's the second track on your new CD.
Girl, don't bother and lock your door. Sat there hollering, darling, don't you love me no more. You always let him in before, and I didn't you? He's just singing the same old song. Just a somebody switch now, wouldn't you? He gonna make love on your satin sheets, wake up on your living room floor. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. And now he's the last of the young night do right. Send the needs you when the daylight. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours.
That's Steve Earle from his new CD, I Feel All Right. How do you think your voice changed after a long period of not singing and after a long period of doing drugs, which can be very hard on the voice? I mean, I think your voice sounds really great and really strong, and I'll confess I'm really surprised at how strong it sounds.
Well, my voice got a rest. One thing about sitting around, you know, like shooting dope, smoking crack for a few years, I wasn't singing. And I really had gotten to the point that I toured so much. And heroin's very hard on your voice. Actively using and singing, heroin relaxes your vocal cords. You could always tell when I was high because my voice would drop about an octave. And you go out and try to sing, you try to bring, you try to hit high notes and bring your vocal cords up to tension, and there's a certain amount of thickening that happens. And that had happened to me. Plus, I had a traumatic injury to my vocal cords. I was arrested for assaulting a police officer in Dallas. I assaulted his nightstick with my neck, is what I did, and it just got into a big thing. They tried to send me to the penitentiary for that, and that was one situation where I was absolutely innocent. But one of my vocal cords bled really badly. So there's a big difference between my voice. If you listen to like Exit Zero and Copperhead Road, it became a lot gravel. There's a lot more gravel in it from that point on, and that's still there. But I got a rest, and I think I'm singing the best on this record. And these are all track vocals on this record. Every vocal on "I Feel Alright" is the straight track, you know, vocal performance. There aren't any overdubs on it.
I've spoken to some performers who are really surprised at what it feels like to perform when they're straight because they'd never really experienced it before.
Yeah.
Is that the position you're in? Is it a different experience to perform straight?
No, it's basically that. I mean, I didn't think that I went out and performed. I would have told you that I'd never performed when I was high, but I obviously had to at the end because if I hadn't been high, I would have been sick.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I performed sick a lot, you know, that ended up happening, you know, something, you know, drug dealers aren't necessarily dependable people. I think I'm a better performer than I've ever been. I'm definitely a better writer than I've ever been. I'm really, really proud of this record. The band right now, is smoking. This whole tour has been a lot of fun, and I was very relieved to find out that I genuinely enjoy my job, because it had gotten sort of miserable for me, because everything's miserable for a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the point, it's really nice to go out on the road and not wake up sick in the morning and not have to worry about where I'm going to get dope in a town I've never been to before. And it's put a lot of the fun back in it for me. And so I'm back to some sort of midlife crisis that's taking place in a bus, but I'm really, really enjoying being out there.
What's the midlife crisis about?
Well, it's just, you know, I'm 41 years old, and I actually am probably more roadworthy than I was when I was 31.
But you don't want to be on the road that much, or?
No, I love being on the road. That's the whole point. I feel like maybe I'm not supposed to.
Oh, I see.
Like
okay.
It as much as I do now. It's not a... You know, it's like, it's, buses are rolling locker rooms. It really gets to you after a while. It's a bunch of people living at fairly close quarters. We had our air conditioner break down in the bus one time in 87. We were going across the desert, and we made a little videotape we called Das Bus, because it got down to everybody sitting around in their underwear playing cards, you know, and because the air conditioning did not work. And in 1990, which was the last full-blown tour that I did, I was thinking at the end of it, boy, I guess I'm just burnt out and I'm tired of doing this. And the truth of the matter, all I was tired of was trying to deal with my drug habit and perform. I'm having more fun making records than I ever have, and more fun than I've had touring in a long, long time.
Steve Earle recorded last year. He'll tour Europe in November and December. Earle has a new CD called El Corazon. Here's another song from it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Surrounding the world tonight, just out of my reach. I hear your heartbeat. It's coming in loud and clear tonight, pounding in my brain. It's calling out you. Thank you.
Coming up, contemporary art's most famous dogs. We talk with artist William Wegman, whose dogs are also his models. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles the band that made the Bob Dylan record that never was. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the mid-60s, rock music was a lot more regional than it is now. A band could make a good living releasing records that only sold in three or four cities. One such band, Mouse and the Traps, wound up making history by releasing the Bob Dylan record that never was.
There's not a whole lot to do in Tyler, Texas. I know, I've spent time there. As in any small town, gossip gets around quickly, as Ronnie Weiss found out one day in 1966. Ronnie was sort of a local star, a session musician at Robin Hood Bryant's local recording studio and leader of a band called Mouse and the Traps. But he couldn't have been prepared for what happened when he took his pretty cousin, visiting from West Texas, for a spin on his motorcycle. Someone called his fiancée in Houston and told her Mouse was running around on her, and she mailed her engagement ring back to him. Devastated, he turned his hurt to anger and wrote her a vicious poem. Somehow, Robin Hood Bryans found out about the poem and convinced Mouse it was a song. It took them 3 hard days to get it recorded, but the result had repercussions that went way beyond Tyler.
Some things are best not said, but since this is your public execution, I think I'm gonna go right on ahead. Mailman brought your letter, babe, where you told me how you feel, and about the things he said he told you, and that is I'm such a heel. But I could never be honest that to you I'd always lied, that he saw me take some other hide for a 2-wheel.
Both Mouse and Robin Hood denied that they were trying to copy Bob Dylan, Robin Hood had a standing invitation from Fraternity Records in Cincinnati to send them anything he thought was good, and they jumped on a public execution and put it out. Although it never charted nationally, it got lots of airplay in various parts of the country, and rumors started circulating that this was Dylan recording under another name. Where he got the Texas accent, nobody bothered to explain, and the song's lyrics are hardly as opaque as Dylan's, but that didn't matter. A legend had been born. The problem was, Mouse and the Traps really didn't sound much like that. They toured the East Texas oil patch, playing rock and soul hits of the day, but the success of a public execution emboldened Ronnie to try his hand at another song.
You see my new angel come walking down the street. You better keep your hat to sidewalk stuck on the bottom of your feet. She looks just like a model from a Cavalier magazine. She gives me all her loving and she never treats me mean. She don't drop names or hug you now about things that she don't know. She's always ready to make it to a foreign art film show. She's just like French press, you made her sugar, made her spice.
Made of sugar, made of spice was what Mouse and the Traps really sounded like. The Yardbirds filtered through Texas with a mad solo from future guitar legend Bugs Henderson, who was in and out of the group. This is the record that should have made them stars, but I bet the reference to Cavalier, a men's magazine, was what killed it. So they tried again.
Sometimes false love's easily won. Yeah, I have never felt so small as I'm standing here, feeling all alone. Like I know you do.
Like I Know You Do was Dylan-esque again, although the guitar here was Bruce Langhorne from Bringing It All Back Home instead of Mike Bloomfield from Highway 61 Revisited. Again, nothing. The lack of hits wasn't hurting the band. They had the run of Robin Hood's studio, and although Fraternity Records was getting a bit testy, they were able to make a good living touring the South and Southwest. But it had been over a year since a public execution, and nothing had happened. Oddly, one of their records was released in Germany, where it had a cult following.
Beg,
Borrow, and Steal went a long way towards establishing Texas as the home of U.S. garage rock with Europeans, a fact that still amazes Texans. They almost made it again with a song called Sometimes You Just Can't Win.
I've never known many sunshiny days, and things seldom work out. They just don't come my way. But I can be happy just to say I've known you, and to see you each morning makes my day seem less blue. For a false-hearted lover.
It was gathering speed around the country when John Fred and the Playboy Band, friends of Mouse and Robin Hood, put out their own version. Things fell apart. By 1970, the band saw the handwriting on the wall and called it quits. Mouse continues to perform, and the band gets together occasionally for reunions, but America has largely forgotten the band that for one shining moment out-Dylaned Dylan.
Ed Ward lives and writes in Berlin. Coming up, the art world's most famous dogs. This is Fresh Air. This is a story of an artist and his dog, or dogs. Dogs who are now among contemporary art's most famous models. William Wegman is an artist who has immortalized his dogs in photographs, paintings, and videos. He has dressed them in human clothes and posed them in scenes that wryly comment on contemporary life and art history. Wegman's most famous dog models, Man Ray and Fay Wray, have both passed on, but he turned Fay Wray's offspring into models. Wegman's art has been shown in museums around the world. Now he writes about his art and his dogs in his new book, Puppies. I spoke with Wegman in 1990. He told me that he got his pet dog, Man Ray, in 1970, at about the same time he started pursuing photography. I asked William Wegman about his first picture of Man Ray.
The photograph was a sock and a dog on the bed, and they both looked alike. So I first photographed him just as another thing around the house. And since he was sleeping so much, I'd plant things on him, for instance, alligators and stuffed squirrels, just props, things like that.
Did you ever wish that Man Ray could have looked at the art and really appreciated what was happening in it and how he was being used?
I really do think of him as a collaborator with me. I know that he was really aware that we were making things, not maybe that first month, but soon afterwards. He knew that we were going here to do photographs or videotapes, and that it wasn't just like playing ball or going to the beach.
When you started doing your photography and using your dog Man Ray in the pictures, this was a period when a lot of artists were beginning to use themselves as art and themselves as the subject of their art. Did you see yourself as using Man Ray instead of yourself during that period?
Well, I couldn't really afford assistance at the time, so I used myself and things around the house. And one of the troubling things about using yourself is, first of all, you don't really have a kind of distance to see what you look like. And it's kind of obnoxious, I think, after a while to be putting yourself on television. Using the dog really helped to work around that basic complaint of mine.
Do you think you went through different Man Ray periods?
Definitely.
Yeah, what are the different periods?
Well, we had a blue period that lasted one day. I guess the first pictures he was used more as a space modulator, his pointing abilities and just standing still. And in the later period, he was more of a character actor as he lost his great figure and started to cover him up. And
you also have posed him in some very classical poses and settings.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I know that I was rather schizophrenic about how I thought of him. I wanted to keep him very noble, but I wanted to do these other things too. And I think when I turned him into a frog, he still somehow got some nobility behind that, other than when he's like this Indian chief in a canoe, which is rather powerful.
It's a very kind of classic American painting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he the dog's in a canoe, and there's mountains behind him, and the sky is kind of overcast, and he has a very noble look on his face, and he's wearing an Indian headdress.
And I thought that might be one of the last photographs, that I might just send him off into that body of water without a paddle and then drive back to New York. It was near the end.
Oh, this was 1981. Was he sick then?
Well, he died in 81 or 82, so about 8 months after that. And towards the end of his life, I did think that each one might be the last series of collaborations. The very last pictures are rather touching and rather personal, too. They're the close-up portraits, the big heads, you might say. Some project a kind of posthumous look to them where he looks like a Roman coin, like Julius Caesar or maybe JFK. Other times he looks kind of like an old, worn-out pet and rather deeply human or deeply canine, I guess.
Were you ever worried that your sense of humor and playfulness with how you used Man Ray would be seen as too frivolous in the art world?
That's a huge question, and not a very funny one. But it's some people, when I first moved to New York, said to me quite immediately, I hate humor in art. And in a way, I agree with them. I don't like humor in art either. It's generally pointed out to be something rather trite. And I remember teachers pointing to Paul Klee and like the twittering machines as being examples of humor in art, and Alexander Calder. I think both are very fine artists, but they're not really funny like, say, a really great comic is funny. So the parallels of art and humor were a little suspect, I think.
Well, do you think of your work as having humor in it?
I think it's pretty hilarious half the time. One of my art dealers said, some of your work is funny and some of it is not so funny. And I think that's true. I mean, if it was funny, I didn't rule it out. And if it was not funny, I didn't rule it out, because that wasn't the only thing going for it.
Well, you've even had some of your work shown on the David Letterman show.
Mm-hmm.
What did that do to your prices? I'm really curious about that. Did they go up or what?
I don't think Letterman had much to do with that. I think that the early Saturday Night Live people,
oh, sure,
I was working
right.
With them, and I think that was an era where it was very exciting for artists to work, to get beyond and outside the gallery or museum or the usual art situations. It was really exciting until we achieved that, and then it was just another thing. So right now it seems to be just another thing, but in the early 70s it was a new frontier.
Was there a period in the late 60s or early 70s where you felt a lot of artists were taking themselves too seriously?
I think especially in video that became a problem, because it was hard to, no one was telling you when to turn it off, you know, just okay, enough. When you're on real TV, you have a producer and a director saying you're off the air or stop, but a lot of performance and video artists in the early 70s just let the machine go on too long, I think, and I hope I was really careful about that, or I was very sensitive about that.
After your dog Man Ray died, you later got another dog, a female of the same breed,
mm-hmm.
And you named her Fay Ray, and you've been using her in photographs since. Did you feel guilty at first, like you would be perceived as trying to replace Man Ray, who you were so close to?
I didn't get another dog that I worked with for 4 years after Man Ray, so it wasn't the day afterwards. And I didn't work with Fay for one whole year because I didn't want to do that. I was especially careful not to do that. I really thought it was over. But one day I just decided to see what it felt like. And it felt great. It felt like I was really denying myself a basic pleasure and right, and that's to photograph a dog. Suddenly I realized who I was for a moment.
It seems to me you're really working with the gender differences between Man Ray and Fay Ray. You know, there's one shot of Fay Ray where she has her claws painted with red Revlon nail polish, and you've got her posed in gowns and exotic clothes.
There's a slight misunderstanding here. There was a piece called Fay Ray where I painted Man Ray's toenails red.
Oh.
But that's
well, you are
me...
gender bending.
But yes, Fay is also much... She's got a whole different shape than Man Ray. I really used Man Ray at the Polaroid studio with those large format pictures when he was 9 years old. And, of course, Fay was 1 year old when I first brought her there. So I was using a young, very thoroughbred-looking, healthy dog as opposed to an aging character actor to the studio.
You know, now that I mention it, I'm remembering that the Fay Ray, where it's a Man Ray who's posed and his claws are painted red, it's actually F-E-Y because, you know, he's Fay with the nail polish on.
That's
so
right.
I forgot about that little pun in there. I should have remembered that.
That was, in fact, the first color Polaroid I took of Man Ray, and I had never used color before, so I used it in a very self-conscious way as a black background with a gray dog and just a the smallest amount of red introduced in a literal way.
Well, let me get back to the subject of gender mm-hmm. and posing your dogs. Do you feel like you're using their gender differently?
Oh, I definitely am. And I'm also using what I mentioned before is their age differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of having had Man Ray pass away, of their mortality. So I know that a 1986 picture when Faye was very young can never be redone again. And that was when she had maximum flexibility. And I think right now she's looking even more feminine, but in a matriarchal way, because she had a litter of puppies. And she's filled out. She looks like a wonderful wild animal and a mother at the same time. This is a strange combination.
A few years ago, back in 1985, you started painting again.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you give up painting in the first place?
Well, in the 60s, painting was dead. You wouldn't be caught doing it. If you were making a painting, you would call it a wall piece. So I didn't want to be caught dead doing that. It was just not really there. As a young, arrogant grad student, I gave up painting in 1966 and went on to do, after wall pieces, I did floor pieces, outdoor pieces, and floating things down the river pieces, and then finally video and photography. So that was my route there.
Well, did you ever have the impulse to paint, even though it wasn't maybe so hip at the time to be doing it?
Well, I think actually when I started painting again in 85, it was more as though the type of paintings that I was doing right before I went to art school as a juvenile or as a, my 10 and 12-year-old paintings of cowboys and Indians and pirate scenes. So I was kind of skipped art education to pick up where I left off at age 12.
When you started painting again, did you feel like you had any technique left? Did you feel like you remembered how to paint?
Oh, I did in a way, but in retrospect, I didn't really. I mean, my first paintings I did, I said, hey, these are great. I really know how to do this. But by next year, I realized that I didn't. So I kind of marched through my techniques pretty quickly.
What got you involved in art in the first place?
I think I just ruled out every other thing by having such bad grades in high school, and I needed an A, and I took art. And my art teacher said, you're really talented. You should go to art school. And so I did, and it kind of really changed my life. Art was really important to me as a child, but as a teenager, I was more interested in sports and didn't see myself going to Canada to play hockey for the Canadiens, so... I took up art instead without knowing really what it was.
William Wegman, recorded in 1990. His dog, Faye Ray, passed away in 1995. Wegman has a new book about his art and his dogs called Puppies. Coming up, new music by Joel Forrester, the composer of the Fresh Air theme. This is Fresh Air. I'm often asked about Joel Forrester, who co-founded the late, great Microscopic Septet and composed the Fresh Air theme. On Monday, I'm going to answer some of those questions about Joel Forrester by presenting an interview and concert with him. The occasion is the release of his first solo piano CD, Stop the Music. It's a co-production of Fresh Air and Koch Records. Let's hear something from it. This is Fate, inspired by a recording by the Boogie Woogie pianist Mead Lux Lewis.
Thank you.
Joel Forrester from his new CD, Stop the Music. Listen for his concert and interview Monday on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.